Dennis, I understand there were two people who influenced your interest in disability sports and post-war Japan as well. A student in one of your classes at Kalamazoo College and your son. Tell us about these influences and how they brought you to writing this book and a synopsis of the book.
Sure. So the origins for the book are, like you mentioned, they're twofold. So I had a student in a class that I taught. It's called Sports in East Asia. It's a class I still teach pretty regularly. And I was doing a project at that point. This was about me back in 2006, doing a project on the history of the Olympics in East Asia. The students were doing group projects, and one of the students came to me and asked if she could do a presentation on a part of her presentation. She was working on the Nagano Paralympics. She wanted to do part of her presentation on the Paralympics. And I, of course, said, sure, because I'm, you know, eager to let students do what they're interested in. But I was kind of taken aback because at that point, I was finishing up a dissertation on the history of sports stars in Japan, was very kind of well-informed about the history of sports. And it was something that I was like, how in the world do I not know about this, you know, major athletic, international athletic event, mm-hmm. you know, the student knows. And so that was kind of, it got me wondering kind of, why do I not know about this? And I found out, of course, when I started looking into it, that part of the reason I didn't know is because there just wasn't much written on it. So that was kind of the first step. And then, you know, I was still finishing up my first book on the history of sports celebrity in Japan. So finished that up and was starting to think about kind of a second project and kind of remembered this earlier kind of conversation I had with the student and kind of what I'd found then. And it was right around that same time that my younger son, he was born with spina bifida and uses a wheelchair part-time, especially for distances and things like that. He was taking an interest in sports. And of course, you know, thinking he's going to be using a wheelchair, we were realizing we probably were going to have to look for adapted sports programs. And so it really became kind of a combination of an academic, you know, intellectual project, you know, sparked by this question from a student, and then a very kind of personal connection with my son, who is very engaged now, and even more so now than he was back then, in kind of wheelchair and adapted sports of various sorts. So it's been kind of that combination of intellectual and personal that led to this project. And like I said, I started, you know, in some ways back in 2006, really early on, really kind of took off in 2011. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Japan had not won the right to host the Olympics or the Paralympics yet. That didn't happen until 2013. So I was actually researching the project before, you know, it became kind of this very timely thing. So it's pretty exciting. Once, you know, they did win the bid, I was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, I'm actually looking at something that's very, very relevant to right now. So what the book does is it covers the history of Japan's engagement with the Paralympic movement. So starting back in the 1960s, Japan was really introduced to the Paralympic movement back in the 1960s. And the Paralympics themselves at that point were pretty young. They'd only started themselves right around 1948. And so Japan's kind of an early pioneer in some senses, kind of joins the movement fairly early on, gets very involved in kind of promoting sports for people with disabilities, both within Japan and even abroad. And so I look at that history of kind of Japan's kind of engagement starting in the 1960s, really on up to the present game. So the book, I, of course, got published. It was published before the games happened. So it doesn't talk about the current games, but it kind of talks about the kind of preparations for the 2020 games and kind of the things that Japan was doing. And along the way, I look at some other events, including, you know, the Nagano Paralympics, which that student had first kind of mentioned to me back in 2006. So I looked at those games. Japan also launched these games called the FISPIC or Far East South Pacific Games for the Disabled back in 1975. This was kind of a regional version of the Paralympics, and Japan played a key role in that. And then there's also a very famous wheelchair marathon that is hosted in Oita, which is a kind of a southern prefecture in Japan down on the island of Kyushu, kind of far away from what people think of as Japan. They often think of Tokyo and Osaka. This is pretty far and kind of remote from those areas. But it's a wheelchair marathon that's been going on for 40 years now. It is, in fact, the world's largest wheelchair marathon ever. And so it continues to be held every year. And so I'd look at that and kind of the impact of that in that local area. So kind of covering different spaces and different times, but kind of overall kind of this, you know, six-decade history of Japan's engagement with the Paralympics.
Tell us a little bit about your research process. And of course, a lot of that happened in Tokyo, elsewhere.
Yeah, so this was a project that, you know, one of the great things and most challenging things about this project was that a lot of the resources for it are just kind of scattered. The organizations that were organizing these events were often kind of very small, sometimes, you know, like only just a handful of people. You know, they didn't have a lot of money, didn't have a lot of support. And so over time, the records just got lost and kind of scattered. So I did do a lot of research in Tokyo and worked with the, what is part of now the Japan Paralympic Committee, the organization, it was at the time called Japan Sports Association for the Disabled. So worked with them, that organizations in Tokyo area. But I also, partly because I was looking at events in different places, I traveled down to Oita and spent significant time down there. I spent time in Kobe, which is another city that hosted another event back in 1989. I spent some time in Nagano, and so I traveled all over the place. And one of the things that, was really challenging because it was materials were scattered, so I would get someplace and find nothing. And then I'd start asking some questions to the people there, and they'd say, "Oh, yeah." That material is up in this place. So I would often have to, make another plan to kind of change it and go to a different location entirely. Sometimes, hours away, by train and stuff like that. But so it was a very kind of intensive process and took me a long time to kind of piece everything all together. But the other, and I spent a lot of time also kind of working, going through old newspapers. So I spent, at one point I spent about a week, in the library in Oita looking through local newspapers, the microfilm of local newspapers, in Japanese, of course, looking for information on the marathon and on this earlier, the FISPIC games that were first held there in 1975. So yeah, there was a lot of kind of things like that. And one of the things I tell people is it was, part of what it showed me is just how close-knit the community of people that work in the kind of adapted sports scene in Japan are. Like, they would introduce me to somebody, or I'd go talk to somebody, and they'd say, "Oh, you need to talk to this person and this person." And those two people would, pass me on to somebody else. But, many of them turned into interviews, and several of the interviews I have in the book are a result of, meeting somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody. So, yeah, really, I mean, a terrific project. I mean, it took me all over Japan, which was, time-intensive and labor-intensive, but I saw some places and got to know some people that I wouldn't otherwise have gotten to know. So that was a lot of fun.
Give us a short history, if you can, Dennis, of disability sports in general and how it has changed the approach or awareness of accessibility and inclusivity throughout society, or lack of.
That is a terrific question, and one that often comes up when people are talking about the Paralympics. And so the history of the Paralympics, as I mentioned a little bit ago, starts in 1948 with the, in England in particular, there's this place called Stoke Mandeville Hospital, which was, built really to treat wounded servicemen and wounded service women from World War II. And so you saw sports being used as part of the rehabilitation process there. Eventually, those games then spread to other places. The official Paralympics were held in Rome in 1960. And then Tokyo actually held the second official Paralympics. So this is, Japan's kind of a very early adopter in many ways of joining the Paralympic movement in 1964, hosting these Paralympics. But even in the case of Japan, there wasn't a lot of exposure to what I refer to as disability sports. Sometimes it's called adapted sports or now parasports. Wasn't a lot of exposure to that in Japan in 1960s. So really the Paralympics are in 1964 kind of introduce disability sports to the larger Japanese population. Now, what's interesting here is there actually is kind of a prehistory of other forms of adapted sports in Japan and lots of other places around the world, because during wartime, as you're trying to work with wounded veterans, one of the tools that was often used for kind of rehabilitate people and bring them back, to be able to kind of get healthier, get stronger, was sports. So there was kind of sports in Japan, sports in lots of other places around the world, tied to kind of wounded service people, and kind of helping them kind of rehabilitate after an injury. So that was happening in Japan, in the 30s. There's also a much longer history that, I just touch on briefly in the book, because it kind of predates the Paralympic movement, of involvement with people that are visually impaired or have hearing impairment. So, and there's a much longer history of sports activities for those groups of people. But the Paralympics themselves really are kind of a post-World War II, really kind of a 1950s, 1960s phenomenon kind of the world over. And they have, at various points, they've kind of emphasized different things. The Paralympics today are very much centered on kind of the idea that they are an elite athletic event, right? So this is the best of the best. They're out for world records and things like that. The early history is much more tied to ideas of rehabilitation and kind of bringing people that are injured or wounded or suffering from some illness or something, getting them back to life, back to society, so they don't have to kind of spend the rest of their life in a hospital or a rehabilitation facility. And so that was kind of true, the world over, that was kind of the early games were very much focused on that rehabilitation. So a big part of the history that I look at in the book is kind of watching how you move from that rehabilitation focus to this elite sports emphasis. And that is, again, kind of, it takes a long time to kind of get there, And at various points, I think that also affects the impact that they have on society. You know, because early on, when the Paralympics are being hosted in Japan in particular, they're using this as a way to kind of promote changes in rehabilitation techniques. So that's kind of the direct kind of impact of the Paralympics, is that you get new ideas being promoted around the ideas of rehabilitation for people, particularly, you know, the early Paralympics were tied specifically to people with spinal cord injuries. So, and so helping these people get back to work and things like that was really the focus early on. There wasn't a lot of talk about accessibility and things like that in the earlier games. What we see now is that, and I really kind of track this in the book, in the Japanese case, this goes back into the 80s, the 1980s, where they start thinking about these events in connection to kind of promoting broader changes in places that are hosting the event. So changes in terms of the built environment, you know, making sure that we have ramps at train stations, making sure there's elevators or lifts of some sort that people can actually use all the same facilities as everyone else. So, you know, that's a phenomenon that started much earlier in Japan than I think a lot of people realize, the 1980s. So we kind of start seeing that kind of come on the scene. And it was really tied in many ways, not just to these sporting events, but to other changes in society. And that's one of the things that's really interesting, is you look at the Paralympics and these sporting events, and you can see how they, I often refer to them as kind of having an amplifying effect. So if there's, if those things are already happening in society, then these events really kind of amplify those efforts, because you're bringing essentially international attention, media attention to some of these issues, and it allows people that maybe were already working on them to say, hey, pay attention to this. And that is, I think, definitely true. It, like I said, I saw that in Kobe in the 1980s, definitely saw it in connection with Nagano in 1998. There's a lot of effort put on kind of promoting, particularly kind of accessibility, kind of improved accessibility. That was a central focus from the beginning of these Tokyo 2020 games, you know, making sure that the built environment was going to be improved for people with disabilities. And again, now part of that's tied in the Japanese context to the fact that Japan has a rapidly aging population, and that's been kind of on the scene. People have known this is going to be happening, you know, really since the late 1970s. They've kind of been watching the demographics and seen that. So that's kind of the accessibility side. Inclusivity also is part of this, because one of the things that has happened around the Paralympics, again, particularly in the Japanese context, but also kind of beyond that, is that you've seen kind of organizers and people that are involved, and particularly the athletes themselves, have become more and more involved in kind of promoting the games, promoting themselves. And so you're starting to see, you know, one of the things that I saw kind of in connection with the 2020 games, there's a lot of activity around helping athletes think about their lives after the games, or when they're done competing, you know, that they need to kind of, they're not going to be an athlete for the rest of their life. So what does that mean? Like how helping people think about kind of job placements and futures and stuff like that. And so this is, that's a newer part of the movement, I think, that is, you know, I think a really positive direction. There's also, of course, barriers to this still, too. You know, one of the big things people talk about is how this leads to changes in attitudes. And I think that, you know, people about disability, and you kind of mentioned that as well, that is something that comes out for sure. You know, you can definitely kind of see there's lots of anecdotes about people kind of not thinking about these issues before and now thinking about them. But there's also, you know, some evidence, and we don't have anything in the Japanese context particularly yet, that attitudes, you know, change, but that change is kind of temporary. And then, you know, people kind of forget about the Paralympics partly after a while, and kind of they kind of are not thinking about these issues anymore. And so that's kind of one of those long-running questions, is kind of what actual impact does it have and kind of societal attitudes towards people with disabilities. So a great question, one that unfortunately I don't have like a hard answer for you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the positive outcomes, but that there are also some negative ones, and you've kind of talked about that already, but I'm wondering about those negatives, what you just mentioned about that there's perhaps not a lasting effect of how we look at accessibility.
Yeah, I think that part of that comes down to you know, these are, especially now, I think even more so than they were early on, these are sports spectacles. You know, they're short-lived, you know, even they're grand and they're spectacular and everybody pays attention to them. But then, you know, part of the point of a spectacle is that it's, you watch it when it's there, and then, you know, you can move on to the next spectacle. And so I think that creates its own kind of complications. And even when you look at events like the marathon that I talk about, where it's been held in the same place for 40 years, you know, it's a yearly event, there's still ways in which it kind of has that kind of spectacle element to it. And it hasn't necessarily translated into direct changes, even in the areas where the athletes are coming every year. They come to the same area, essentially. And there's still many places that have not made themselves barrier-free, right? So there's still plenty of kind of built environment issues. Social attitudes, too. I mean, again, we don't have like data to kind of support all that. But I think there's lots of kind of potential there for it to have a negative impact in terms of kind of social attitudes. Because if somebody comes into an event and they've never really thought about disability before, and the only encounter they have with disability is the Paralympics, well, then are they walking around then thinking that everybody has to be a Paralympian? You know, so this is one of those questions and issues that people with disabilities sometimes are express kind of reservations about the Paralympics about, because it kind of raises this perception that, you know, well, if they can do it, why can't you? Why do you need special access to this facility? When I saw this person, you know, run, you know, 100 meters and, you know, close to the same time as an Olympian, you know, and so there is that potential there for kind of a negative kind of social impact or societal impact. And so that is I think it's a very real concern. And, you know, it's very difficult to kind of measure kind of the partly because in order to do it, you would actually need to kind of talk to exactly the same people. You know, you can kind of measure things indirectly, but social attitudes are very difficult to kind of determine. And I think, you know, based on kind of what we see is that, you know, Japan, as I said, it has a 60-year history of kind of hosting these events. And you do see some positive kind of long-term trends. You know, one example is increased media coverage. So more and more people are actually exposed to this and getting access to it. But if the article is really kind of reinforcing kind of negative stereotypes in some ways, then that even if it's more, that's not necessarily a net positive, right? So those are kind of the types of issues that, you know, I look a little bit in my research. This is something that people who work on the history of disability sports and work on kind of, you know, the kind of sociology, sports sociology in this field, they're always kind of trying to explore those issues and look at those questions.
I'm thinking, too, about what you're saying about expectations that anybody who's facing some kind of physical disability should now be at that elite athletic level. Most of us healthy people don't participate in triathlons or marathons or...
Right, right.
Same idea.
Right, exactly. But I think the Paralympics, again, because sometimes it's the only experience people might have with experiencing, watching, observing people with disabilities. So I think it creates potentially false expectations is the concern there.
Is that the same as when you talk about an inspirational element and that can be a problem sometimes?
Well, I think that's definitely related to that. And I think that there's this idea sometimes that the Paralympics are tied to something called inspiration porn. And that book you're talking about in particular is that people, again, maybe they don't know anything about the Olympics, or the Paralympics don't know anything about kind of people with athletes with disability. They watch this and they kind of just say like, wow, that's so inspiring. The common example of this is those inspirational posters that you see in people's offices and things like that sometimes.
Yeah.
And there's a whole series of them that are people, literally it's just a person performing in a sport, and it'll say something like, what's your excuse? Which, you know, there's no story there. We don't understand any of the context. That person wasn't making an excuse. That person maybe didn't even want themselves to be used in this particular way. You know, and so those types of images and kind of ideas, and, you know, one of the things that is very common when you talk about the Paralympics, or you look at media coverage of the Paralympics, this is true in the Japanese context, it's definitely true kind of outside of the Japanese context, is you will hear the word inspiring repeatedly, or read the word inspiring repeatedly. I had a Japanese reporter when I was talking to him, asked him about this question. And he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, in the past, he's like, it was almost the Japanese phrase is a pillow word. It's basically kind of, it becomes like an epithet that is tied to the Paralympics, like inspiring Paralympics, inspiring Paralympian. And so, you know, I think that's definitely true in lots of other contexts. So it's this question of kind of, well, what's inspiring about this? Is it just the athletic accomplishment itself, or is it the fact that they're doing something because they have a disability and you don't expect that? And so, because I, you know, as I mentioned, I think in my writing, and I've written a couple of pieces about this as well, is that, you know, it is a, sports are inspiring. We get inspired by them. So it's not like that itself is the problem. It's kind of what's inspiring you, what is the reason it's inspiring, how is it being used, and things like that. And that's where it gets kind of complicated and fuzzy. But I think that's it's a real issue that a lot of people in the kind of field of disability sports are talking about and thinking about as well.
Your book concludes as we're heading into the Tokyo Olympics, which are going on right now as we speak. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can update us at all on what happens after your book ends in this arena.
So what happens is that, you know, the book, I think the last section I wrote, I was finishing it up right around 2019. And then the final edits came back to me and copy edits came back to me as the pandemic was starting to hit. So the games were still a go when I first got them. And then, of course, they got delayed. So that's been the biggest kind of hiccup since the book came out. Is that, of course, they didn't happen in 2020. They're happening in 2021. At this point, you know, the Olympics, as you mentioned, are going forward. We still do not know. The Paralympics are supposed to happen. But, you know, some of the concerns, I've talked to some people that are, you know, tied into the Paralympics. And the concerns are that, you know, if the situation goes badly in the Olympics, which, you know, it's kind of, I've been watching this and it's not great right now. In terms of COVID numbers and things like that.
Yeah.
If the situation goes badly, that, you know, the Paralympics could end up getting canceled. Even if the Olympics happen, the Paralympics might not. So there's a lot of uncertainty at this moment. At this point, they're saying they're going to be going forward. There was talk I read recently that if on the positive side, if things go better, they might actually allow fans at the Paralympics. Because the Olympics, as many people probably know, are not allowing any fans or very, very few fans at the games at all. And so a lot of this is very uncertain, and that's kind of where things stand at the moment. A lot of the athletes that were training for 2020 games, I mentioned in one of the chapters I go through and talk about several of the athletes, including a couple who were planning to participate in 2020. A lot of their preparations got held up for a year. They, you know, some of the qualifying events got delayed. And so there was some people who didn't even know if they were going to qualify for the games or if their qualifying event was going to happen and things like that. So it's been just kind of really chaotic for a lot of people. And I think, you know, one of the things that the positive side of the Paralympics, that this is getting a lot more traction in Japan, a lot more attention in the lead up to 2020. I myself am a little worried that, you know, that all the positive stuff that could come out of the Paralympics is getting overshadowed by, and understandably overshadowed, I think, but overshadowed by the very real concerns that people have about kind of hosting these games right now. So even if they happen, you know, I think that the storyline about these games is very much going to center on kind of COVID and the pandemic and, you know, whether they should have happened or not at all, which are completely valid questions. But that means that some of the things that are really positive about these games might not be as much a part of the story as they would have been otherwise. So that's kind of another kind of development that is, you know, unfortunate, a little bit unfortunate for the case of the Paralympics this year.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your time to tell us about this book.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.